Side 11, Ilium by Dan Simmons, continuing on page 322.
"Perhaps they're expressing their gratitude for your saving them," said the Ionian. "I know I would, if I had arms or legs left to patch you with."
Monmouth said nothing, but he could hardly believe that this was the reason for the contact. He hadn't seen any emotions from the LGM, not even when their translators had withered and died after communicating with him. And he found it hard to believe they were all grateful, even though the LGM were good enough sailors to realize that the ship would have sunk had it not been for Monmouth's intervention.
"Or maybe they just think you're lucky and they're trying to get some of it to rub off," added Orfu.
Before Monmouth could express his opinion of this idea, the last of the LGM in line had reached him, but instead of patting the Moravec carbon fiber shoulder and moving on, the little green man went to his knees, lifted Monmouth's right hand and set it against his chest. "Oh no," Monmouth groaned to Orfu, "they want to do the communication thing again."
"That's good," said the Ionian. "We have questions to ask."
"The answers aren't worth the death of another of these little green men," said Monmouth. He was pulling his hand back as hard as the black-eyed LGM was tugging it toward his green chest.
"It might well be worth it," said Orfu. "Even if the LGM unit does undergo anything similar to our idea of death, which I doubt. Besides, it's his initiative. Let him make contact."
Monmouth quit struggling and let the LGM pull his hand against its chest, into its chest. Once again there was the shocking, sickening feeling of his fingers sliding through flesh and being immersed in the warm, thick saline solution, of his hand contacting and then encircling that pulsing organ the size of a human heart.
"Try holding it a bit less tightly this time," suggested Orfu. "If the communication is truly through molecular packets of organic nanobites, less surface area of contact might cut down the volume of their thoughts."
Monmouth nodded, realizing that Orfu could not see his nod, but then focused only on the strange vibration from his hand through his arm to his mind as the little green man began the conversation. "We give you gratitude for saving our ship."
"You're welcome,"
Monmouth said aloud, focusing his thoughts through spoken language at the same time he shared the exchange with Orfu on the tight beam band. "Who are you?" he asked. "What do you call yourselves?"
"Zex."
The word meant nothing to Monmouth. He felt the LGM's communication organ pulse in his hand and had the wild urge to release it, to rip his fist from this doomed person's chest. But that would help neither of them now.
"Do you know this word, Zex?" Monmouth asked Orfu.
"Just a minute," said Orfu, accessing third-tier memory. "Here it is. From a day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. It was a slang term related to the Russian word sharashka, a special scientific or technical institute staffed with prisoners. The prisoners of these Soviet labor camps were called Zex."
"Well," said Monmouth, "I don't think these chlorophyll-based Martian LGM are prisoners of some short-lived Earth regime from more than 2,000 years ago."
The entire exchange with Orfu had taken less than 2 seconds. To the little green man, he said,
"Would you tell us where you're from?"
This time the answer was not in words but images. Green fields, a blue sky, a sun much larger than the one in Mars's sky. A distant range of mountains hazy in the thick air.
"Earth?"
said Monmouth, shocked.
"Not the star in the night sky here," was the LGM's response. "A different Earth."
Monmouth pondered this but did not know how to phrase a clarifying question other than his clumsy, "Which Earth, then?" The little green man answered only with the same images of green fields, distant mountains, an Earth-like view of the sun. Monmouth could feel this LGM's energy fading, the heart-like organ pulsing with less vitality. "I'm killing him," he thought in panic.
"Ask about the stone faces," came Orfu on the comm line.
"Who is the man represented in the stone faces?" Monmouth asked dully.
"The Magus. He of the books.
Lord of the Son of Sycorax, who brought us here. Mimagus is master even of Setebos, our Lord's mother's god.
Magus, sent Monmouth to Orphu. It means magician, sorcerer, as in the three magi.
God damn it, Monmouth sent fiercely, angrily. He was wasting this dying green person's time. The heart organ pulsed more weakly with every second that passed. I know what Magus means, but I don't believe in magic, and neither do you, Orphu.
But it appears that our LGM do, responded Orphu. Ask about the dwellers on Olympus.
Who are the chariot people on Olympus? Monmouth asked dutifully, feeling that he was asking all the wrong questions, but he could think of none better to pose.
Near gods, responded the little green man through bursts of nanobite images, decohering to words. Held in thrall here by a bitter heart that bides its time and bites.
Who is? Began Monmouth, but too late. The little green man had suddenly toppled backward, the Moravec's hand holding nothing but a desiccated wrapper instead of a pulsing heart now. The LGM began to wither and contract as soon as his body hit the deck. Clear fluid ran across the boards as the little person's anthracite eyes sank into its collapsing green face, then brown face, as the skin changed color and wrinkled inward and ceased to be the shape of a man. Other LGM came closer and carried the shriveled brown skin envelope away.
Monmouth began shivering uncontrollably. We have to find another communicator and finish this conversation, said Orphu.
Not now, said Monmouth between shudders.
A bitter heart that bides its time and bites, quoted Orphu. You must have recognized that.
Monmouth shook his head dully, remembered his friend's blindness, and said, No.
But you're the Shakespeare scholar.
That's not from Shakespeare, said Monmouth.
No, agreed Orphu. Browning.
Caliban upon Setebos. I've never heard of it, said Monmouth. He managed to get to his feet, 2 feet, and stagger to the rail. The water curling back alongside the Falucca now was more blue than red. Monmouth knew that if he were a human, he'd be vomiting over the side now.
Caliban, Orphu all but shouted over the tight beam line. A bitter heart that bides its time and bites.
The deformed creature, part sea beast, part man, had a mother who was a witch, Sycorax, and her god was Setebos. Monmouth remembered the dying LGM using those words, but he couldn't concentrate on their meaning now. The entire conversation had been like stringing bloody beads on a sinew of living tissue.
Could the LGM have heard us reciting from the Tempest 3 days ago, when you first regained control of the Falucca? Asked Orphu.
Heard us? Echoed Monmouth. They don't have ears.
Then it's us, not them, echoing to this strange new reality, rumbled the Ionian, but with a rumble more ominous than his usual laughter.
What are you talking about? Asked Monmouth. Red cliffs had become visible to the west. They rose 700 or 800 meters above the water of the widening delta of Kander Chasma.
We seem to be in some mad dream, said Orphu, but the logic here is consistent in its own mad way.
What are you talking about? Repeated Monmouth. He was in no mood for more games.
We know the identity of the stone face now, said Orphu.
We do?
Yes. The Magus. He of the books, Lord of the Son of Sycorax.
Monmouth's mind wouldn't work to connect these obvious dots. His system was still filled with the alien surge of nanobites, a peaceful but dying clarity that was alien to Monmouth, but welcome. Very welcome.
Who? He said to Orphu, not caring if his friend thought him dull.
Prospero, said Orphu.
30. Achaean compound, coast of Ilium.
So far this evening's gone just as Homer said it would. The Trojans have built their hundreds of watchfires just beyond the Achaean trench, the Greeks' last line of defense down here on the beach. But the Achaeans, beaten so soundly through the long day and evening into night, have foregone even cooking fires in their milling confusion. I've morphed into the form of old Phoenix and joined the gathering near Agamemnon's tent, where the weeping son of Atreus...
Weeping? This king of Greek kings weeping is urging his commanders to take their men and flee. I've seen Agamemnon use this strategy before, pretending to want to run away so as to rally his men to defiance. But this time, it's obvious the older king is in earnest. Agamemnon, hair wild, armor bloody, muddy cheeks rivuleted with tears, wants his men to flee for their lives. It's Diomedes who challenges Agamemnon, all but calling their king a coward, and promising, with Sthenelus alone, if all the others flee, to fight on alone until we see the fixed fate of Ilium. The other Achaeans shout support for this bluster, and then it is old Nestor, citing his years as his passport to speak, who suggests that everyone calm down, have something to eat, post sentries, send men to watch the trench and ramparts, and talk this over before stampeding for the ships, the sea, and home. And this, just as Homer described, is what they do. Then the seven chiefs of the guard, led off by Nestor's middle-aged son, Thrasymedes, each take their 100 fighters out to set up new defensive positions between trench and rampart, and to light their dinner fires. The handful of Greek fires joined soon by Agamemnon's feast fire. Seems pitiful, set against the hundreds of Trojan watch fires just beyond the trench, their sparks leaping high toward the lowering thunderclouds. Here at Agamemnon's council feast, attended by all the assembled Achaean lords and commanders, the dialogue continues just as Homer reported it. Nestor speaks first, praising Agamemnon's courage and sagacity, but telling him, essentially, that he really screwed the pooch when he chose to steal the slave girl Briseis from Achilles. "You're not lying there, old man," is Agamemnon's honest response. "I was insane. Insane and blind to offend Achilles so." The great king pauses, but no one of the dozens of chiefs hunkered around the central cooking fire rises to argue with him. "Mad blind I was," continued Agamemnon, "and not even I would deny it. Zeus loves that young man so that Achilles is worth an entire battalion, no, an entire army." Still no one argues the point. "And since I was made mad and blind by my own rage, I'll set things right now by paying a king's ransom to bring him back to Achaean ranks." Here the assembled chieftains, Odysseus included, make grumbling sounds of agreement around their mouthfuls of beef and chicken. "Here, before you all assembled, I will count off my gifts in their splendor to purchase young Achilles' love," cries Agamemnon. 7 tripods untouched by flame, 10 talents weight of gold, 20 servant shined and new burnished cauldrons, 12 great stallions, fleet of foot, who've won races and prizes for me," and blah, and blah, and blah, just as Homer wrote, just as I predicted to you earlier. And also, as I predicted, Agamemnon vows to return Briseis unbedded, as well as 20 Trojan women, if and after the walls of Ilium fall, of course. And, as a sort of pièce de résistance, the pick of Agamemnon's own 3 daughters, Chrysothemis, Laodike, and Iphianassa. And as an inveterate skolic, I note the continuity error here with earlier and later tales, especially the absence of Electra and the possible confusion of Iphigenia's name. But that's not important right now. And then, for dessert, Agamemnon throws in the 7 citadels strongly settled. And just as Homer has reported, Agamemnon offers these things in lieu of an apology. "All this I will offer him if he will end his wrath," cries the son of Atreus to his listening commanders. Thunder rumbles and lightning flickers overhead as if Zeus is impatient. "But let Achilles submit to me. Only Hades, the god of death, is as pitiless and relentless as this upstart. Let Achilles yield place and bow to me. I am the elderborn and the kinglier king. I claim, the greater man." Well, so much for apologies. It's raining now, a steady drizzle laced with Zeus's lightning, and drunken cries from the Trojan lines, less than 100 yards away, drift across the rain-filled ditch and muddy ramparts. "I want the embassy to Achilles to be chosen so I can walk up the beach with Odysseus and Ajax and get on with it." This is the most important night of my life, at least of this second life as a Skellig, and I keep rehearsing what I will say to Achilles. If you will change all of our fates, you must find the fulcrum. I think I've found it, or at least a fulcrum. Certainly, nothing will be the same for the Greeks and gods and Trojans, or for me, if I do what I plan to do this night. When old Phoenix speaks at this embassy to Achilles, it will be not only to end Achilles' wrath, but to unite his cause with Hector's, to turn both Greeks and Trojans against the gods themselves. Nestor suddenly cries out, "Son of Atreus, generous marshal and lord of men, our Agamemnon, no man, not even our prince of men, Peleus' son Achilles, could spurn such gifts. Come, we'll send a small embassy of carefully chosen men to carry these offers and our love to Achilles' tent this night. Quick, whomever my eye lights on, let these take the duty." Robed in old Phoenix's flesh, I step to the edge of the circle near Big Ajax, making myself visible to Nestor. "First of all," cries Nestor, "let Ajax the Great take up this task. And with Big Ajax, let our tactful and brilliant king Odysseus add his counsel. For heralds I choose Odias and Eurybates to escort our embassy. Water for all their hands now, and a moment of prayerful silence while we all beseech Zeus in our own manner, that the great god will show us mercy, and let Achilles smile on our entreaty." I stand in shock while the ablutions are administered and the commanders bow their heads in silent prayer. Nestor ends the silence by urging on the embassy of four, not five, by shouting at the leaving men, "Try hard now! Bring him around and make him pity us, our invincible, pitiless Achilles!" And the two ambassadors and the two heralds leave our circle of firelight and walk away up the beach. I wasn't chosen. Phoenix wasn't chosen. He hasn't even been mentioned. Homer was wrong. The events of this Ilium have just wildly diverged from the events of the Iliad, and suddenly I'm as blind to future events as Helen and the other players here. As blind as the gods above, as blind as Homer himself, damn his missing eyes. Stumbling on my old skinny legs, on useless Phoenix old skinny legs, I shove my way through the circle of Greek chieftains and run along the crashing water's edge to try to catch up to Big Ajax and Odysseus. I catch up to the two halfway down the dark beach to Achilles' compound. Ajax and Odysseus are alone, speaking softly as they walk along the wet sand. They stop when I come up to them.
"What is it, Phoenix, son of Amintor?" asks Big Ajax. "I was surprised to see you at the king's feast, since word is that you've stayed close to your Myrmidon healers in recent months. Has Agamemnon sent you after us with some final admonition?" Gasping, as if I'm actually as old as Phoenix, I say, "Greetings, noble Ajax and royal Odysseus. In truth, Lord Agamemnon has sent me to join you in your embassy to Achilles."
Big Ajax looks perplexed at this, but Odysseus looks downright suspicious.
"Why would Agamemnon choose you for this duty, honorable elder? Why would you even be in Agamemnon's camp this dangerous night, when the Trojans bay across our ditch like hungry dogs?"
I have no answer for the second question, so I try to bluff my way through the first.
"Nestor suggested that I join you to help gain Achilles' ear, and Agamemnon thought it a wise suggestion." "Come then," says Ajax the Greater, "join us, Phoenix."
"But do not speak unless I tell you to," says Odysseus, still squinting at me as if I were the impostor I truly am. "Nestor and Agamemnon may have seen some reason for you to visit Achilles' tent, but there can be no reason for you to speak."
"But," I begin, "I have no argument. If I'm not allowed to speak after Odysseus, lose the fulcrum, I fail. If I'm not allowed to speak, the events of this night will diverge from the Iliad. But I realize they already have diverged. Phoenix should have been chosen by Nestor, his presence in the embassy seconded by Agamemnon. What's going on here?" "If you join us in Achilles' tent, old Phoenix," warns Odysseus, "you must wait in the foyer with the heralds, Odias and Eurybates, and enter or speak only on my command. These are my conditions." "But," I begin again,
and see the uselessness of any protest. If Odysseus becomes more suspicious and marches me back to Agamemnon's camp, my ruse will be up, and with it my entire plan to turn the mortals against the gods. Yes, Odysseus, I say, nodding like the old horseman and tutor Phoenix was. As you command. Odysseus and Big Ajax walk along the crashing sea, and I follow. I've talked about Achilles' tent, and you might picture some sort of backyard camping tent, but the son of Peleus lives in a canvas compound that's closer in size to the main tent of a traveling circus I recall from my childhood. Recall from what I am beginning to remember from my childhood. Thomas Hockenberry had a life, it seems, and after almost a decade here, some of the memories are leaking back into my mind. This night, the hundreds of tents and campfires around Achilles' main tent paint as chaotic a scene as the rest of the mile-long Achaean encampment, with some of Achilles' loyal myrmidons packing his black ships for departure. Others looking to the ramparts to defend their area of beach should the Trojans win through before dawn, and still others gathering around campfires much as Agamemnon's commanders had been. Odysseus and Eurybates have announced our arrival to the captains of the guard, and Achilles' personal guards snap to attention and allow us into the inner compound. We leave the beach and climb the low dune to the rise where Achilles' main tent is situated. I follow the two Achaeans in, Big Ajax ducking his head to go through the lower inner entrance, Odysseus almost a foot shorter than his comrade, entering without having to duck his head. Odysseus turns and gestures me to a place in the foyer near the entrance. I can see and hear what is happening within, but I won't be part of it if I stay here. Achilles, just as Homer described, is playing his lyre and singing an epic song of ancient heroes, not so different than the Iliad itself. The lyre, I know, was a spoil of war won when Achilles conquered Thebe and murdered Andromache's father, Aetion. Hector's wife had grown up listening to this same silver lyre being played in the hearth of her royal home there. Now Patroclus, Achilles' dearest friend, sits across from him, waiting for Achilles to finish his part of the song so that Patroclus can sing the remaining lines. Achilles quits plucking the instrument and stands in surprise as Ajax and Odysseus enter. Patroclus scrambles to his feet as well. "Welcome," cries Achilles. He gestures to Patroclus. "Look, dear friends have come. I must be needed badly to bring them here. And my dearest friends in all the Achaean ranks, even in my anger, I acknowledge this." He leads the two emissaries to low couches and throws rich purple carpets across the cushioned frames. To Patroclus, Achilles says, "Come, son of Menoetius, a bigger wine bowl. Here, put it here. We'll mix stronger wine, a cup for each of my noble guests, since these men who have come under my roof are those I love the best." I watch the unfolding of these surprisingly gracious rituals of heroic hospitality. Patroclus sets a heavy chopping block next to the fire and lays out the chines of a sheep and a goat next to the fat marbled back cut of a pig. Automedon, friend and charioteer of both Achilles and Patroclus, holds the slabs of meat while Achilles cuts off prize strips, salts each, and sets them on spits. Patroclus builds up the fire for a minute and then scatters the embers and sets the spits across the hottest part of the fire, salting each strip again. I realized I'm famished. If I am called in to speak now, if all of our fates depended on it, I couldn't do it because my mouth is watering so. As if hearing my stomach rumbling, Achilles looks out into the foyer and almost freezes with surprise. "Phoenix! Honored mentor, noble horseman! I thought you ill in your tent these weeks last. Come in, come in!" With that, the young hero comes into the foyer, embraces me, and leads me into the firelit center of his home. The air smelling now of roasting mutton and pork. Odysseus shoots daggers from his eyes, silently warning me to keep silent during the discussions. "Be seated, beloved Phoenix," says Achilles, this old man's former student. But he sets me on red cushions, not purple, and farther from the fire than he is either Odysseus or Ajax. Achilles is loyal to his old friends, but he understands protocol. Patroclus brings in wicker baskets of fresh-baked bread, and Achilles rakes the meat from their spits and sets the steaming portions out on wooden platters. "Let us sacrifice to the gods, dear friends," Achilles says, nodding to Patroclus, who tosses the firstlings, the strips of meat chosen as offerings, into the flames. "Now eat," commands Achilles, and all of us set into the bread and wine and meat with a will. Even while I'm chewing and enjoying the food, my mind is racing. How do I get to make the speech I have to make to change the fates of everyone here, of the gods themselves? It seemed so simple an hour earlier, but Odysseus hasn't bought my statement that Agamemnon sent me along as an emissary. In the poem, Odysseus speaks soon, relaying Agamemnon's offer to Achilles. And then Achilles replies, and what I've suggested to my students is the most powerful and beautiful speech in the Iliad. Then Phoenix gives his long three-part monologue, part personal history, part the parable of the prayers, and part allegory of Achilles' situation in the myth of Meleagros, a paradigma where a mythical hero waits too long to accept offered gifts and to fight for his friends. All in all, Phoenix's speech is by far the most interesting entreaty from the three ambassadors sent to persuade Achilles. And according to the Iliad, it is Phoenix's argument that persuades the angry Achilles to back away from his vow to sail away the next morning. By the time Ajax speaks after me, Achilles will agree to stay around the next day to see what the Trojans do and, if necessary, to protect his own ships from the enemy. My plan is to repeat parts of Phoenix's long speech from memory, then veer away to insert my own suggestions. But I see Odysseus frowning at me from across the tent, and know that I'm not going to get the chance. And what if I do? I've considered the fact that the gods will be monitoring this assembly. It's one of the key elements of the Iliad, after all. Although perhaps only Zeus knows that in advance. But even without advance knowledge, some of the gods and goddesses must be watching this meeting in their video pools and on their image tabula. Zeus has ordered them not to intervene this day, and most are complying with his ultimatum. But that must make their curiosity about the embassy to Achilles even greater. If Achilles agrees to Agamemnon's bribe price and the power of Odysseus' persuasion this night, then Hector's offensive, and perhaps even the will of Zeus himself, will be thwarted. Achilles is a one-man army. So if I suborn him to heresy this night as I've planned, if I try to rally Achilles to war against the gods, won't Zeus intervene at once, blasting this tent and all its occupants? And even if Zeus holds back his wrath, I can imagine Athena or Hera or Apollo or one of the other interested parties swooping down to destroy this. Phoenix, for suggesting a course of action so inimical to their ends. I've imagined these things, of course, but trusted the QT medallion and the Hades helmet to save me. But so what if I save myself by fleeing again, but these heroes end up killed or dissuaded by the wrath of the gods? The whole plan would have been for nothing, and my existence revealed to all the gods. The Hades helmet and QT medallion won't help me then. They'll track me to the ends of the earth, to prehistorical Indiana, if need be. And that, as they say, will be that. Perhaps Odysseus has done me a service by not letting me speak. Then why am I here? When we've all feasted well, empty platters pushed aside, and only crusts of bread remaining in the baskets, and are ready for our third cup of wine, I see Ajax nod ever so slightly to Odysseus. The great strategist takes the hint and lifts his cup in a toast to Achilles. Your health, Achilles! We all drink, and the young hero bows his blonde head in acknowledgement. I see that we lack nothing for this feast, continues Odysseus, his voice surprisingly low and soft, almost mellifluous. Of all the great Achaean captains, this bearded man is the softest spoken and the most devious. We lack nothing either in Agamemnon's camp nor here in the house of the son of Peleus. But it's not the bounteous feast that's on our minds this stormy night, no. It's a terrible disaster, bred and willed by the gods that we're looking on and fearing tonight. Odysseus goes on slowly, smoothly, never rushing, rarely reaching for rhetorical effect. He describes the rout of the afternoon, the Trojans' victory, the Achaeans' panic and will to flee, and Zeus's complicity. These brazen Trojans and their boasting allies have pitched their tents within a stone's throw of our ships, Achilles, continues Odysseus. speaking as if Achilles has not already heard all of this from Patroclus, Automedon, and his other friends, or simply watched it from the hill outside his tent. "Nothing can stop them now," continues Odysseus. "That's their boast. And thousands of their watchfires back that boast with threat tonight. They plan to bring those flames to our ships at first light, then hurl themselves at our blackened hulls, slaughtering the survivors. And Zeus, son of Cronos, sends them signs of encouragement, firebolts crashing on our left wing, all the while Hector rages on furiously, drunk on his strength. He fears nothing, Achilles, neither man nor god. Hector is like a rabid, frenzied dog this day, and the demons of catalepsis have him in their grip." Odysseus pauses. Achilles says nothing. His face shows nothing. His friend Patroclus is watching Achilles' face all this time, but the hero does not even glance his way. Achilles would make one hell of a poker player. "Hector is eager for the dawn," Odysseus continues, voice even softer now, "since at first light he threatens to shear the horns from our ship's sterns, light those ships with consuming fire, and with all our comrades trapped against the burning hulls, rout and kill and cut down us Achaeans to the man. A nightmare, Achilles. I fear it with all my heart. I fear the gods will give Hector the means to carry out these threats, and our destiny will be to die here on the plains of Ilium, far from the horse-pasturing hills of Argos." Achilles says nothing when Odysseus pauses again. The dying embers crack. Somewhere several tents away, someone is playing a slow dirge on a lyre. From the opposite direction comes the drunken laugh of a soldier who obviously thinks himself doomed. "Up with you then, Achilles," says Odysseus, voice rising at last. "Now, rise with us now, 11th hour though it be, if you want to rescue the doomed sons of the Achaeans from Trojan slaughter." And now Odysseus is asking Achilles to put aside his wrath and describes Agamemnon's offer, using the same words Agamemnon had chosen to list his unfired tripods and dozen racehorses and so on, and so forth. I think he lingers a bit too long on the description of unbedded Briseis and the Trojan maidens waiting to be ravished, and Agamemnon's three beautiful daughters, but he ends with a passionate peroration, reminding Achilles of his own father's advice, Peleus' admonition to value friendship over quarrels. "But if the son of Atreus is too much hated in your heart for you to accept these gifts," finishes Odysseus, "at least take pity on all the rest of us Achaeans. Join our fight and save us now, and we will honor you like a god. Also, remember that if your wrath keeps you from fighting, if your disdain sends you home over the wine-dark sea before this war with Troy is finished, you'll never know if you could have killed Hector. This is your chance for that Aristea, Achilles, since Hector's murderous frenzy will bring him to close combat tomorrow after all these years of his aloofness behind the high walls of Ilium. Stay and fight with us, noble Achilles, and now, for the first time, you can meet Hector head-on in combat." I have to admit, Odysseus' speech has been one hell of a performance. I might be persuaded, if I were the young demigod lounging on the cushions 6 feet from me in the tent. We all sit silently until Achilles sets down his cup of wine and answers. "Noble son of Laertes, seed of Zeus, resourceful tactician, dear Odysseus, I have to tell you frankly and honestly how I feel and how all this will end, so you won't keep crowding me, one embassy after another, coaxing and murmuring one after the other like a line of cooing doves. As much as I detest the doorways of death, Hades' dark gates, so do I detest a man who says one thing with his mouth but hides another in his heart." I blink at that. Is this a deep dig at Odysseus, resourceful tactician, known by all Achaeans as someone who will bend the truth when it serves his purposes? Perhaps, but Odysseus does not react in any way, so I keep Phoenix's expression neutral. "I'll say this clearly," continues Achilles. "Will Agamemnon win me back, persuade me with all these gifts?" The hero all but spits this last word. "No, not for all the world. nor could all the armies and captains of the Achaeans convince me to return, since their gratitude is too little and too late. Where was the gratitude of the Achaeans during my years upon years of warring against their enemies, battle after battle, year after year in harness, fighting every day with no end in sight? 12 cities I've stormed from my ships, 11 I've claimed by wetting the fertile loam of Ilium's lands with Trojan blood. And from all these cities I dragged heaps of plunder, mountains of loot, great crying herds of beautiful women, and always I gave the best of the lot to Agamemnon, that son of Atreus, safe in his racing black ships or skulking far behind the lines. And he would take it all and more. Oh, yes, sometimes he'd hand out scraps to you and the other commanders, but always he kept the lion's share for himself. To all of you, whose loyalty he needs to prop up his regime, he gives. Only from me does he take, including the slave girl who would have been my bride. Well, fuck it, and fuck him, and fuck her, my dear comrades. Let Agamemnon bed Briseis, to the hilt if the old man is up to it. With his grievances aired anew, Achilles goes on to question why his Myrmidons and the Achaeans and the Argives should even be fighting this war. For Helen, with her loose and lustrous hair, he asks contemptuously, saying that Menelaus and his brother Agamemnon are not the only men here with missing wives, reminding Odysseus of his own wife Penelope, left alone these 10 long years. And I think of Helen sitting up in bed just these few nights ago, her loose and lustrous hair hanging over her shoulders, her pale breasts white in the starlight. It's hard to pay attention to Achilles, even though this speech is as wonderful and surprising as Homer reported. In this short talk, Achilles undermines the very heroic code that makes him a superhero, the code of conduct that makes him a god in the eyes of his men and equals. Achilles says that he has no ambition to battle glorious Hector, neither will to kill him nor will to die by his hand. Achilles says that he is taking his men and sailing at dawn, leaving the Achaeans to their fates, leaving them to Hector's mercy when the Trojan and his hordes cross the ditch and rampart tomorrow. Achilles says that Agamemnon is a dog armored in shamelessness, and that he wouldn't marry one of the old king's daughters even if she somehow ended up with Aphrodite's looks and Athena's crafts. Then Achilles says something truly amazing. He confesses that his mother, the goddess Thetis, told him that two fates would bear him on to his day of death. One where he stays here, lays siege to Troy, kills Hector, but then dies himself within a few days. In that direction, his mother told him, lies eternal glory in the memories of men and gods alike. His other fate lies in flight, sailing home, losing his pride and glory, but living a long, happy life. The fates are his to choose, his mother told him years ago. And, Achilles tells us now, he chooses life. Here, this hero, this mass of muscle and testosterone, this living legend demigod, he chooses life over glory. It's enough to make Odysseus squint in disbelief and Ajax gape. So, Odysseus, commanders of Achaea, report my answer. Let them figure out how to save the hollow ships and save the man who will be pressed back to these very ships, burning hulls at this time tomorrow. As for Silent Phoenix here, I jump 3 inches off the red cushion when he turns toward me. I've been so lost in preparing what I have to say and the moral implications of it that I've forgotten that we're in a discussion here. Phoenix, says Achilles, smiling indulgently, while Odysseus and Ajax here must report back to their master, you are free to spend the night here with Patroclus and me, and voyage home with us come the dawn, but only if Phoenix wishes. I would never force any man to go. This is my chance to speak. Ignoring Odysseus' scowl, I look around, stand awkwardly, clear my throat to begin Phoenix's long speech. How does it start? All those years of teaching and studying it, of learning the nuance of every Greek word, and now my mind is a blank. Ajax stands. While that old fool tries to decide whether to run away with you or not, Achilles, I'll tell you that you're as much of a fool as old Phoenix. Achilles, the man-killer who will brook no insult to his person, the hero who will let all of his Achaean friends be murdered rather than suffer indignities over a slave girl from Agamemnon, merely smiles and cocks an eyebrow at Ajax's direct insult.
"Giving up glory and 20 beautiful women for one woman you can't even have, bah!" cries Ajax and turns away. "Come, Odysseus, this golden boy has never drunk from the teat of human friendship. Let's leave him to his wrath and deliver our dark message to the waiting Achaeans. Tomorrow's sunrise is coming fast enough, and I, for one, need some sleep before the fight. If I'm going to die tomorrow, I don't want to die sleepy." Odysseus nods, stands, nods again in the direction of Achilles, and follows big Ajax out of the tent. "I'm still standing with my mouth agape, ready to deliver Phoenix's long three-part speech, that clever speech, with my own clever amendments and hidden agendas." Patroclus and Achilles stand, stretch, and exchange glances. Obviously, they've been expecting this embassy, and both men knew Achilles' shocking answer in advance. "Phoenix, old father, loved by the gods," Achilles says warmly. "I don't know what really brought you here this stormy night, but, well, I remember when I was a lad, and you'd lift me and carry me off to bed after lessons. Stay here this night, Phoenix. Patroclus and Automedon will prepare a soft bed for you. In the morning we'll sail for home, and you can come, or not." He gestures and goes into his sleeping quarters in the back of the tent, and I stand here like the fool I am, speechless in every sense, stunned at this wild veering away from the plot line of the Iliad. Achilles has to be persuaded to stay, even if he doesn't join in the fighting, so the Iliad works itself out this way, the Trojans winning again and the Greeks in full retreat, with all of their great commanders wounded, Odysseus, Agamemnon, Menelaus, Diomedes, all of them. Then, feeling sympathy for his friends while knowing that Achilles will never join the fight, Patroclus will put on Achilles' golden armor and rout the Trojans back until, in single combat with Hector, Patroclus is killed, his body violated and desecrated. That will bring Achilles out of his tent, filled with killing wrath, thus sealing the fate of Hector and Ilium, and Andromache and Helen and all the rest of us. He's really leaving? I can't quite grasp this. Not only didn't I find the fulcrum and change things, now the entire Iliad has run off the rails. More than 9 years I've been a skolic here, watching and observing and reporting to the muse, and never once has there been a deep rift between the events in this war and Homer's reporting in the poem. Now, this. If Achilles leaves, which he shows every indication of doing, come the dawn, the Achaeans will be defeated, their ships burned, Ilium saved, and Hector, not Achilles, will be the great hero of the epic. It seems unlikely that Odysseus' Odyssey will ever happen, and certainly not the way it's sung now. Everything has changed. Just because the real Phoenix wasn't here to give his real speech? Or have the gods been tampering with this fulcrum before I had a chance to? I'll never know. My chance to persuade Achilles and Odysseus in council, my clever plan is lost forever. "Come, old Phoenix," Patroclus says, taking my arm as if I'm a child, leading me to a side room in the great tent where my cushions and coverlets are laid out. "It's time to go to bed. Tomorrow's another day."
31. Jerusalem.
"What is it?" asked Harmon. He and Demon were standing in the shadow of the western wall in Jerusalem, just a few steps behind Savi, and all three were staring up at the solid beam of blue light that stabbed vertically into the darkening sky.
"I think it's my friends," said the old woman. "All 9,113 of my friends, all the old styles that were swept up in the final facts."
Demon looked at Harmon and realized that they were both doubtful about Savi's mental condition.
"Your friends?" said Demon. "That's a blue light."
Savi tore her gaze away from the beam. It was illuminating the top of the ancient buildings and walls around them now, bathing everything in blue glow as the daylight faded further. And she looked at them with what might have been a rueful smile. "Yes, that beam of blue light. My friends." She gestured for them to follow and began leading them away from the courtyard, away from the wall back the way they came, away from the base of the shaft of blue light. "The posts told us that the final fax was a way of storing us while they cleaned up the world," continued Savi.
her voice soft but still echoing in the narrow alleyways here. The plan was, they explained, to reduce our codes. We were all fax codes to the post-humans even then, my friends. Reduce our codes and put us in a continuous neutrino loop for 10,000 years while they tidied up the planet.
What does that mean? Said Harmon. Tidy up the planet.
They walked under a long archway, and Demon could just barely see Savi's face as she smiled again.
Things got messy toward the end of the Lost Age, she said. Messier after the Rubicon. Then came the demented times. Freelance Arnists were bringing back dinosaurs and terror birds, and long-extinct botanic forms screwing up the planet's ecology, even as the biosphere and datasphere were beginning to merge into the self-aware noosphere, the logosphere. The post-humans had already fled to their rings by then. The Earth's sentient noosphere didn't trust them any longer, and for good reason. The posts were experimenting with quantum teleportation, opening portals onto places they didn't understand, opening doors they shouldn't have opened. Harmon stopped as they came out onto a broader street.
Would you make sense, Savi? We don't understand two-thirds of what you're talking about.
How could you? Asked Savi, looking at Harmon with an expression of either pain or severe displeasure.
How could you understand anything? No history, no technology, no books.
We have books, said Harmon, his voice defensive. Savi laughed.
What does all this talk of dinosaurs and noospheres have to do with the blue beam? Asked Demon.
Savi sat on a low wall. The breeze had come up and it whistled through broken tiles on the rooftops. The air was cooling quickly.
They needed to get us out of the way while they cleaned things up, repeated Savi. A torus of neutrinos, they said. No mass, no muss, no fuss. 10,000 years for them to tidy up the Earth. Less than a blink of an eye for us old styles, so they said.
But they left you behind, said Harmon, yes.
By accident?
I doubt it, said the old woman. Very little the posts did was by accident.
Perhaps they had some purpose for me. Perhaps they were punishing me for digging into histories better left buried.
That's what I was, you know, an historian, cultural historian.
She laughed again for no reason that Demon could fathom.
So neutrinos are blue? Asked Demon.
He was determined to get a straight answer.
She laughed again. I very much doubt it. I don't think neutrinos have any color or charm. But that blue beam appears every Tisha B'Av, every ninth of Av. And something tells me that the rest of the old-style humans, all my friends, are stored and coded in that blue beam.
I don't think that machine is generating the beam. I think the Earth passes through the neutrino beam every year at this point, on its orbit, and that machine merely makes the beam visible.
But it hasn't been 10,000 years, said Harmon, only 1,400, you say, since the final fax.
Savi nods tiredly.
And things haven't been tidied up much since the final fax, have they, my young friends?
She stands, lifts her backpack, and starts down the narrow street before suddenly freezing.
A Voynix, says Demon. Now we won't have to walk back to the Sunny. We'll have it fetch a carryall and...
The Voynix, an iron and leather silhouette in the western archway ahead of them, suddenly retracted its manipulatives and clicked cutting blades into place. Then it charged directly at them, running along the side of the building on all fours like a frenzied spider. Savi had been wildly rummaging in her pack since Demon had pointed, and now she brought out the black plastic and metal device, a gun she'd called it, and aimed it at the charging Voynix. Demon was too shocked to move. He was the closest to the scuttling Voynix, still 8 feet up the wall and loping on all fours, but the creature seemed focused on Savi, and was hurtling right past Demon. Suddenly the evening air was torn by a noise. Rip! As if wooden paddles were being dragged against stone slats, and the wall flew apart in a spray of masonry chips, the Voynix was thrown backward and down onto the cobblestones, and Savi stepped forward, aimed and fired again. Scores of fingertip-sized holes appeared in the Voynix's carapace and metallic hood. Its right arm flew up as if it was going to throw something at them, but then more flechettes struck it, and the arm became unhinged, tore off, flew backward. The Voynich struggled to its feet, one cutting blade still whirring. Savi shot it again, almost severing it at the waist. Its blue, milky internal fluid spattered the walls and paving stones. What remained of the Voynichs fell, twitched, and lay still. Armin and Demon cautiously moved closer, trying not to step in the blue fluid or on pieces of the creature. This was the second Voynichs they'd seen destroyed in 2 days. "Come on," said Savi, pulling an empty crystal flechette clip from her gun and slapping in a replacement. "If there are more around, we're in serious trouble. We have to get to the Sonian quickly." Savi led them down a narrow street, turned into a narrower alley, then turned again into something smaller than an alley, a crack between stone buildings. They emerged into a wide, dusty courtyard, went under a stone arch, and came into a smaller courtyard. "Hurry," whispered Savi. She led them up an outside staircase, across a rooftop terrace dewed with dust, and then up a rotted wooden ladder past shuttered windows to a higher rooftop. "What are we doing?" whispered Harmon, as the three came out into the cool night air atop the building. "Don't we have to get back to the Sony?" "I'll call it to us," said Savi. She went to one knee by the low rooftop wall and activated her Proxnet function, shielding the glow above her palm. Harmon crouched next to her. Demon remained standing. The air up here was cool after the heat of the cobblestoned streets and narrow alleys, and the view was interesting from this point on the hill. To their right stabbed the blue beam, bathing all the domes and rooftops and streets in its pale light. It was dark now, and stars were visible across the sky. The city had no lights burning, but ancient domes and spires and some arches gleamed to the blue light. Savi had told them that the walled compound on the hill where the beam burned was called Haram es-Sharif, or Temple Mount. And the two domed structures at the base of the beam machine were the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. "Itba al-Yahud!" came a sudden shrill amplified cry from the streets behind them. The cry was repeated from the warren of narrow streets to their west, between them and the Sony. "Itba al-Yahud!" Savi looked up from her palm display. "What is that?" asked Harmon in a shrill whisper. "Voynichs don't speak." "No," said Savi, "it's coming from the ancient automated muezzin call to prayer speakers on all the mosques." "Itba al-Yahud!" came the tremulous but urgent voice echoing from all over the dark city. "Al-Jihad!" cried the amplified voice. "Itba al-Yahud!" "Damn," said Savi, looking at her palm display. "No wonder it isn't responding to the remote." "What?" Demon and Harmon both stepped closer, crouching to see the rectangular display floating inches above her palm. The view was of the front of the Sony where they had landed it. The fields of rocks and walled city glowed greenly in the camera's low-light vision. Closer, looming over the lens, scores of Voynichs were milling around the Sony, throwing their bodies onto the machine, battering it with boulders and stacking huge rocks on top of it. "They defeated the force field and broke something," whispered Savi. "The Sony's not coming to us."
"Allahu Akbar!" cried the echoing, amplified, trembling voices from all points of the low-roofed city. "Itba al-Yahud! Itba al-Yahud!" The three walked to the edge of the rooftop. For a second, Demon thought that the buildings and cobblestone streets and walled courtyards were trembling, crumbling, dissolving in the reflected blue light. But then he realized that things were crawling across the stone and domes and walls and rooftops. Thousands of things, like an invasion of roaches, scrambling wildly toward the blue light. But then Demon realized how far away the shimmering, crawling buildings were, computed the scale, and realized that it wasn't roaches or spiders scrambling and scrabbling toward them, but Voynichs. "Itba al-Yahud!" screamed the metallic voice from everywhere. The syllables echoed back from the mount without losing their demented urgency. "What does that mean?" asked Demon. Savi was watching the blue-lighted Voynichs scrabbling closer over rooftops and through the maze of narrow, winding streets. The wave of huge insectoid shapes was less than 2 city blocks away now, close enough that they could all hear the scratch and tear of cutting blade and sharp manipulators on stone and tile. Savi turned slowly.
Her face looked older than ever in the pulsing blue light. "Itba al-Yahud," she repeated softly. "Kill the Jew." 32. Achilles' Tent. I have to kill Patroclus. That realization comes to me like a whisper in the night as I lie here in the Myrmidon encampment in Achilles' tent wrapped in the shell of Phoenix's old body. I have to kill Patroclus. I've never killed anyone, Jesus Christ. I protested the Vietnam War as a college student. Couldn't put the family dog to sleep. Had to have my wife take her to the vet, and considered myself a pacifist for most of my academic life. I've never hit another man, for Christ's sake. I have to kill Patroclus. It's the only way. I trusted that rhetoric would do it, old Phoenix's revised rhetoric, that rhetoric would persuade the man-killer Achilles into meeting with Hector, into ending this war, into burying the hatchet. Yeah, right in my forehead. Achilles' decision to leave, to return to a long life of pleasure but little glory, is deeply shocking to this Scholic, to any student of the Iliad, but it makes sense. Honor is still more important than life to Achilles, but after Agamemnon's insults, he sees no honor in killing Hector and then being killed in turn. Odysseus, that ultimate rhetorician, was eloquent in his explanation and evocation of how the living Achaeans and countless generations after would honor Achilles' memory. But it's not their honor that Achilles cares about. Only his sense of honor counts here. And there will be no honor now for him in killing Agamemnon's enemies and dying for Agamemnon's and Menelaus' objectives. Only Achilles' honor counts, and he'd rather sail for home in a few hours and live the life of a lesser mortal, forsaking his chance to be part of this band of brothers 20 centuries before Prince Hal and Agincourt, than compromise any more honor here on the bloody plains of Ilium. I see that now. Why didn't I see it before? If Odysseus could not convince Achilles to fight, Odysseus of the crafty ways and silver tongue, why did I think I'd succeed? I was a fool. Homer made me a fool, but I was still a fool. I have to kill Patroclus. Not long after Odysseus and Big Ajax left, just after the torches and tripod fires were extinguished in the main room of Achilles' tent, I heard slave girls being escorted in for the pleasure of Achilles and Patroclus. I'd never seen either of these slave girls, but I knew their names. Homer leaves no one nameless in the Iliad. Achilles' girl, I couldn't have used that word while teaching at Indiana University in my other life, or the political correctness police would have had my job. But here it doesn't seem appropriate to call these giggling sex toys women, was named Diomede, Phorbas' daughter from the Isle of Lesbos, although she was no lesbian. Patroclus' main squeeze was named Iphis. I almost laughed out loud as I caught a glimpse of them through the folds in the tent door. Achilles, who is tall and blonde and statuesque and chiseled with muscle, preferred the tiny, stocky brunette and large-breasted Diomede. Patroclus, who is much shorter than Achilles and dark-haired, had opted for the tall, blonde, thin, small-busted Iphis. For half an hour or so, I could hear the women's laughter, the men's rough conversation, and then the moans and cries from all four in Achilles' sleeping chamber. Obviously, the hero and his pal had no qualms about having sex in the same room with each other, even commenting on it while it was occurring, which makes me think more of Bloomington, Indiana, male realtors or lodge brothers having a weekend in the big city than it does of the noble warriors of this heroic age. Barbaric. Then the girls left, giggling again, and there was silence except for muttered exchanges between the guards outside the tent and the crackle of brazier flames keeping those guards warm. That, and monstrous snoring from Achilles' sleeping chamber. I hadn't heard Patroclus leave, so either he or the golden hero sounded like he had a deviated septum. Now I lie here and consider my options. No, first I morph out of Phoenix's old form, damn the consequences, and lie here as Thomas Hockenberry and consider my options. I have my hand on the QT medallion, I can jump to Helen's sleeping chambers again. I know for a fact that Paris is out beyond the trench here, miles from the city, waiting for dawn to join Hector in the final slaughter of Greeks and the burning of the Achaean ships. Helen might be happy to see me, or she might have no further use or amusement from the night visitor named Hockenberry. Now, strange that someone here other than another Skolik knows my name. And she might call her guards. No problem with that, I can always QT away in an instant. To what destination? I can give up this mad plan to change the course of the Iliad, abandon my goal formed on the night that Agamemnon and Achilles first quarreled, of defying the immortal gods, QT to Olympus, apologize to the Muse and to Aphrodite when they decant her, ask Zeus for a personal audience and beg for a pardon. What are the odds that they'd forgive and forget, Hockenbush? You stole the Hades helmet, the QT medallion, and all your Skolik gear and used them for your own purposes. You fled from the Muse. Worst of all, you hijacked a flying chariot and tried to kill Aphrodite in her healing tank. My best hope after apologizing would be that Zeus or Aphrodite or the Muse would kill me quickly, rather than turn me inside out or cast me down into the murky pit of Tartarus, where I'd probably be eaten alive by Cronos and the other barbarous titans banished there by Zeus. No, I've buttered my bread and now I have to lie in it, or however that phrase goes, in for a penny, in for a pound, no guts, no glory. Better safe than sorry. But while I'm struggling for a cliché, any cliché, a profound realization settles over me in a profoundly unprofessorial but absolutely convincing phrasing. If I don't think of something soon, I am well and truly fucked. I can go reason with Odysseus. Odysseus is the sane one here, the civilized man, the wise tactician. Odysseus may be the answer tonight. I'll have a better chance convincing Odysseus that an end to this war with the Trojans and common cause against the all-too-human gods is an option.
To tell you the truth, I always enjoyed teaching the Odyssey to my students more than the Iliad. Fitzgerald's sensibilities in the Odyssey are so much more humane than the rough bellicosity of Mandelbaum's and Lattimore's and Fagel's and even Pope's Iliad.
I was mistaken to think that I could find the fulcrum of events by coming here with the embassy to Achilles. No, Achilles isn't the man to approach this knight, what's left of this knight, but Odysseus, son of Laertes, a man who might understand a scholar's pleas and the compelling logic of peace. I actually rise and touch the QT medallion, ready to go find Odysseus and make my plea. There's only one little problem that keeps me from QTing in search of Odysseus. If Homer was telling the truth, I know what's happening elsewhere while I've been lying in this tent and brooding. Agamemnon and Menelaus can't sleep for their own brooding on the course of events, and sometime around now, or perhaps in the last hour or so, the older and more royal brother calls for Nestor and asks for ideas that might stave off the massacre that seems so imminent. Nestor recommends a war council with Diomedes, Odysseus, Little Ajax, and some of the other Achaean captains. Once these leaders are gathered, Nestor suggests that the boldest among them should sneak behind Trojan lines and divine Hector's intentions. Will the Trojans and their allies try to burn the ships in a few hours' time? Or is it possible that Hector has had enough blood and victory for now and will lead his hordes back into the city to celebrate before opening further hostilities? Diomedes and Odysseus are chosen to go find out, and since the two have come to this council from sleep without their own weapons, they are given gear by the guards, including a bull's hide helmet for Diomedes and a famous Mycenaean boar's tusk helmet for Odysseus. With the skin of a lion that Diomedes has thrown across his shoulders and Odysseus' black leather helmet studded around with white teeth, the two warriors are terrifying to look upon. Should I QT to that conference and observe it? There's no reason. Diomedes and Odysseus may already have left on their commando raid, or Homer might have been lying or mistaken about this action, just as he was with Phoenix's speech. Besides, it won't help with my problem right now. I'm not a Skolik anymore, just a man trying to find a way to survive and end this war. Or at least, turn it against the gods. Although there's another part of tonight's action elsewhere that comes to mind and chills my blood. When Diomedes and Odysseus venture out, they discover Dolon, the spearman whose body I borrowed just 2 nights ago when I followed Hector into his meeting with Helen and Paris, who's been sent behind Achaean lines to spy for Hector. Dolon's carrying a reflex bow and wearing a cap made of weasel skin, and he's sneaking carefully through the field of newly fallen dead in the dark, hunting for a way across the trench and past the Greek guards on the line. But sharp-eyed Odysseus sees him coming in the darkness, and he and Diomedes lie among the corpses, surprise Dolon, and disarm him. The Trojan begs for his life. Odysseus will tell him, if he hasn't already, that death is the last thing you have to worry about. And then calmly, quietly pumps the young spearman for specific information about the disposition of Hector's Trojans and their allies. Dolon tells all. The location of the Carians and Paeonians and Leleges and Corconians, the sleeping areas of the crack Pelasgians and the stolid, faithful Lycians and the cock-strutting Mysians, the whereabouts of the camp of the famed Phrygian horsemen and the Meonian charioteers. He tells everything and begs for his life. He even suggests that they tie him up and keep him prisoner until they see for themselves that his information is correct. Odysseus will smile, or perhaps he already has, and will pat the shaking, terrified Dolon on the shoulder. I remember the muscled balance of Dolon's body from when I was morphed as the boy. And then the son of Laertes and Diomedes will strip the young man's cap and bow and wolf pelt, Odysseus softly telling the terrified boy that they're disarming him before bringing him to camp as a prisoner. And then Diomedes will hack Dolon's head off with one savage blow of his sword. Dolon's head will still be shrieking for mercy as it bounces across the sand. And Odysseus will hold up the boy's spear and bow and weasel cap and wolf pelt and will offer them to Pallas Athena, crying, "Rejoice in these, goddess, they're yours. Now guide us to the Thracian camp so that we can kill more men and steal their horses. Those spoils, too, will be yours." Barbarians. I'm among barbarians. Even the gods here are barbarians. One thing is sure, I won't be going to talk to Odysseus tonight. But why does Patroclus have to die? Because I was right the first time. Achilles is the key, the fulcrum through which I can shift the fates of everyone, gods and men alike. I don't think that Achilles will leave in a few hours when dawn stretches forth her rosy fingertips. I think Achilles will stay and observe just as he does in Homer's tale, taking pleasure in further misfortune for the Greeks. I think now that the Achaeans will come crawl at my knees, Achilles will say after the next bad day, when all the great captains, Agamemnon, Menelaus, Diomedes, and Odysseus are hurt. And this is after last night's embassy to Achilles, where they've already groveled to get him back. Achilles will take pleasure in the defeat of his fellow Argives and Achaeans, and it's only Hector's murder of his friend Patroclus, snoring now in the next room, that will bring the man-killer back to the battlefield. So, Patroclus has to die to turn the direction of events now. I stand and take inventory of the things I'm wearing and carrying. A short sword, yes, to blend in with the troops, but I've never used the damn thing, and no, it doesn't even have an edge. The muse gave it to me as a prop, not a weapon. For real defense, these past 9 years, I've been equipped with the lightweight layer of impact armor, enough to stop a sword thrust or errant spear or arrow, we were told in the Skolik barracks, although I have never had to test it, and the 50,000-volt taser, tucked into the end of the shotgun mic baton we all carry. That weapon was designed only to stun an aggressor long enough for us to escape to a QT portal. Other hardware includes the lenses that enhance my vision, filters that boost my hearing, the stolen cowl-like Hades helmet furled around my shoulders, the QT medallion on its chain around my neck, and the morphing bracelet on my wrist. Suddenly, a plan, or at least part of a plan, begins to form in my tired mind. I act before I can lose my nerve, pulling up the Hades helmet, disappearing from mortal and divine sight, feeling like Frodo or Bilbo, or the Gollum slipping on the ring that binds them all. I tiptoe from the sleeping annex where they laid out Phoenix's cushion to Achilles' bedchamber. Achilles and Patroclus are sleeping together naked, the slave girls long gone, Patroclus' arm flung across the man-killer's shoulders. This sight in the dim light stops me in my tracks. Achilles is gay? That means that stupid gay and lesbian-obsessed junior professor in the department was right. His ranting papers correct. All that politically correct babble true. I shake this out of my head. It means nothing except that I'm 3,000 years away from 21st century Indiana and that I don't know what I'm seeing. These two men have just fornicated with slave girls for 2 hours and fell asleep where they lay. Besides, who cares about the secret love life of Achilles? I trigger the morphing band and bring up the scan I'd made 2 days earlier in the Hall of the Gods on Olympus. I don't know if this will work. The other Skoliks used to laugh at the idea. Probability waves shift through quantum layers I can't perceive. The air seems to quiver, stand still, then quiver again. I slip the soft Hades helmet off my head and become visible. Visible as Pallas Athena, Tritogenia, third-born of the gods, daughter of Zeus, defender of the Achaeans. 9 feet tall, radiating my own divine light, I step closer to the bed as both Achilles and Patroclus awake with a start. I can feel the instability in every atom in this morphed form. The morphing bracelet was not designed for us to take the form of gods. But although my shape hums like a hard-struck harp, I use the short time this quantum substitution will give me. I work to ignore the sensation, not only of suddenly having breasts and a vagina, I've never morphed into the form of a woman before, but also ignore the sensation of being a goddess. The form is unstable. I know in my heart that I haven't assumed the powers of Athena, just borrowed her quantum shell for these few seconds. Feeling as if there's going to be some nuclear reaction, a morphing meltdown if I don't shed the quantum waveform of Athena quickly, I speak fast. Achilles, wake, on your feet! Goddess, cries the fleet-footed man-killer, rolling from the cushions to the floor. What brings you here in the middle of the night, child of Zeus? Rubbing his eyes, Patroclus also struggles to his feet. Both men are naked, their bodies more sculpted and beautiful than the finest Greek statues, their uncircumcised penises dangling against their muscled and tanned thighs. Be quiet, I bellow. Athena's voice comes out amplified, superhuman. I know that I'm waking the others in Achilles' tent and probably alarming the guards outside. I have less than a minute. As if to prove my point, Athena's golden arm quivers, shifts to Professor Thomas Hockenberry's pale and hairy forearm, and then morphs back to Athena's. I see that Achilles' eyes are downcast and that he hasn't noticed. Patroclus stares, wide-eyed, confused. Goddess, if I have offended you, begins Achilles, raising his eyes but keeping his head bowed. Silence, I bellow. Can an ant crawling in the dirt offend a man? Can the lowest and ugliest fish in the sea offend the sailor whose thoughts are on other things? An ant, repeats Achilles, his handsome sculpted face showing a rebuked child's confusion. You're all less than ants to the gods, I roar, taking a step closer so that Athena's radiance flickers over them like radioactive light. You've amused us with your deaths, Achilles, son of Peleus and idiot child of Thetis. Idiot child, repeats Achilles, red rising to his high cheekbones. Goddess, how have I... Silence, coward! I've amplified Athena's voice until they could hear this insult in Agamemnon's camp, almost a mile down the beach. We care nothing for you, nothing for any of you. Your deaths amuse us, but your cowardice does not, swift-running Achilles. I sneer these last few words, turning the poet's honorific into a demeaning insult. Achilles balls his fists and takes a half step forward, as if approaching a foe. Goddess, Pallas Athena, defender of Achaeans, I have always offered you the finest sacrifices. A coward's sacrifice means nothing to us on Olympus, I roar. I feel the probability wave that is the real goddess Athena approaching critical collapse. I have only seconds in this half-morphed form. "We'll take and burn our own sacrifice from this moment on," I say. And Athena's arm extends toward Patroclus, the baton hidden under my forearm, my finger on the activator. "If you want your boyfriend's corpse, fight your way to the halls of Olympus to get it, coward Achilles." I taser Patroclus in the center of his tanned, hairless chest. The near-invisible electrodes and invisible wires carrying 50,000 volts into him. Patroclus seizes his chest as if struck by a lightning bolt, cries out, twitches and writhes as if in the throes of an epileptic fit, pisses himself and collapses. Before Achilles can react, the swift-footed warrior stands there naked with his hands balled into fists and his eyes bugging out, too shocked to move. I have Athena take two steps forward, grab the collapsed and apparently dead Patroclus by his hair, and drag him roughly across the floor. Achilles unfreezes, snarls, and pulls his sword from its scabbard on the chair. Still dragging the limp Patroclus by his hair, Athena's form quivering out of quantum morph stability now, and as static-lashed as a bad TV picture, I touch the medallion at my throat and quantum teleport Patroclus and me the hell out of Achilles' tent. 33. Jerusalem and the Mediterranean Basin. Savvy led Demon and Harmon off the roof down the ladders and steps and into one of the narrow alleys. The starlight and blue glow from the neutrino beam on the temple mount gave just enough illumination for them not to crash into walls or fall into wells as they ran. But Demon soon fell behind, gasping. He'd never run, even as a child. It was an absurd thing to do. Closer now, less than a short block away in the maze of flat-topped buildings and labyrinthine alleys, came the scrabbling of the hundreds of hurrying voyniks. "Idba al-Yahud," rasped the voice from those loudspeakers Savi had called Muezzin. Savi led them across a cobblestone street, down another dark, narrow alley, across a small clearing strewn with glowing human bones, and into an interior courtyard that was even darker than the alley. The pad-thump and manipulator scratch of voyniks running at high speed along walls was closer now. "Itba al-Yahud!" the amplified cry seemed more urgent. "Only Savi here is a Jew, whatever that is," thought Demon, his lungs burning, staggering to keep up. "If Harmon and I let her go on by herself, the voyniks will leave us alone, probably even help us get home. There's no reason we should share her fate." Harmon was running hard behind the old woman as she crossed the courtyard and ducked through a low arch into the ruins of an ancient building. "Or I can take care of myself," thought Demon. "Harmon can stay with her if he wants." Demon slid to a stop on the dusty cobblestones. Harmon paused in the black rectangle of a doorway and waved him on.
Demon looked over his shoulder toward the sounds behind them, like claws or hollow bones rattling against stone,
and in the light of the blue beam, saw the first of a dozen voyniks running in the street they had just crossed. Demon felt his heart lurch. He wasn't used to the emotion of fear, and found the thought of doing anything alone right now as the most terrifying option. And then he ran into the dark doorway behind Harmon and the old woman. Savi led the way down a series of increasingly narrow staircases, each flight of steps older and more worn than the one above. Four flights down, she tugged a flashlight from her backpack and flicked it on as the last of the reflected light disappeared from the dim blue glow above. The narrow beam illuminated a wall at the bottom of the narrowest flight of steps, and Demon's heart lurched again. Then he saw what looked like a flap of dirty burlap hung over a hole he was sure was too small to allow him through. "Hurry," whispered Savi. She pulled the gunny sack material aside and slipped through the hole. Demon heard echoes as if from a well. Harmon quickly followed the old woman into the blackness. Demon heard scrabblings from the ruined house above, but no Voynich's footsteps sounded on the stairs. Not yet, at least. He leaned into the little hole, squeezed his narrow shoulders through, found that he was hanging over a bottomless black circle less than 4 feet across, and then his flailing hands found iron rungs in the wall opposite, and he grunted as he pulled his torso and hips through the opening, scraping skin against ancient plaster until his legs were free and dangling. Then his feet found purchase on the rusty metal rungs, and he began clambering down toward the muted sounds of Savi and Harmon descending below him. Cold air flowed up past his face. Demon's fingers and feet shifted uncertainly downward from cold rung to cold rung. He heard whispers below, and suddenly there were no rungs under his feet, and he dropped 4 or 5 feet onto a brick floor. Harmon's hands steadied him. He could see the circle of Savi's flashlight illuminating a round tunnel made of ancient stones or bricks. "This way," she whispered, and began running again, bent over to avoid the low ceiling. Harmon and Demon scrambled along behind, trying to avoid the irregular bricks in the curved floor by watching the circle of her flashlight rather than their own feet. They came to a junction of tunnels. Savi checked her glowing palm function, and they followed the left passage. "I don't hear the Voynichs behind us," said Harmon. He'd spoken softly, but his voice still echoed from the curved brick. The tallest of the three, Harmon had to bend the most to walk. "They're above us," said Savi, "following us on the streets." "Are they using Proxnet?" asked Demon. "Yes." She paused at another junction, chose the center of three smaller passages. They all had to bend low here. Harmon looked at Demon again, obviously curious about the Proxnet comment, but not asking any questions now. "They're following you, you know," said Savi, pausing to look first at Demon and then at Harmon. The harsh flashlight beam made her face look even older and more skull-like. "Not you?" said Demon, surprised. She shook her head. "I don't register on any nets. The Voynichs don't even know I'm here. It's you two who are showing up out of bounds on their Farnet and Proxnet scans. I think the nearest fax portal is Mantua. They know you didn't walk this far." "Where are we going now?" whispered Harmon. "The Sony?" Savi shook her head again. Her gray hair was wet with sweat or condensation and plastered to her skull. "These tunnels don't go beyond the old city, and the Voynichs have rendered the Sony inoperable by now. I'm headed for the crawler." "Crawler?" said Demon, but rather than explain, Savi turned away and began leading them through the tunnels again. 100 paces further, and the round brick tunnel became a narrow corridor. 30 paces beyond that, and the corridor became stairs, and then a wall stopped them. Demon felt his heart trying to pound through his chest wall. "What do we do?" he said. "What do we do? What do we do?" He spun away from the light, listening hard in the darkness for Voynich's sounds. "Climb." Demon turned back to see Savi being lifted into another vertical well, this one narrower than the one they had descended, and then the light was gone as the flashlight bobbed above them. Harmon jumped up for the lowest rung, missed, cursed softly, jumped again, caught it, and pulled himself up. Demon could barely see the outline of the older man's arm as he reached down. "Come on, Demon, hurry. The Voynichs are probably already up there waiting for us." "Then why are we climbing up there? Come on." Harmon seized Demon's forearm in the darkness and pulled him up. The Voynichs broke through the wall of the building just as the three humans were scrambling onto the crawler. The huge machine took up much of the space in the central area of what Savi said had once been a large church. When they came up the stairs from the cellar, Savi's flashlight flicking this way and that, Demon had paused on the steps, not sure of what he was seeing. End of side 11.